So I'm just going to ask you to answer briefly. I think this one will go to Greg Mitchell. Why hasn't WikiLeaks made all the documents public for everyone to read the source material unredacted? That's a question from Paul Wright, editor of Prison Legal News.
Well, I wish I knew that. I do know that there are behind the scenes right now sort of unprecedented steps they're trying to take that would release all those documents to a wide variety of journalists. They are, I don't know why they haven't been able to publish them all. I think it's a matter of, of logistics or resources. What they have done in a savvy way, as someone previously mentioned, was that they have, as various places around the globe, Tunisia and Egypt and Bahrain, Yemen, Libya, and many other countries that maybe we don't know that much about, they go in and cherry pick cables that are tied to what's going on in that country. And they've done it so that when events have come up in, for example, in Egypt, they had numerous cables that were very relevant to abuses, torture, police actions, Mubarak's corruption, Suleiman's involvement in torture, and so forth. So I think on the one hand, we may lament that they haven't been able to get all the documents out there, but on the other hand, they have released some in a very timely way that have helped fuel these all these revolts in the Middle East and North Africa.
This one will start with Micha and whoever wants to respond to him. Why did you say Julian Assange is autocratic? And why and how is it pertinent to the overall good that his organization has done?
Well, this is based on the statements of some of his former associates, all of whom wanted the organization to be run in a more democratic manner than he runs it. Daniel Domscheit-Berg, who was his close partner for several years in running WikiLeaks and who broke with him back in the fall, both over the inability to have a discussion over how WikiLeaks was handling the war logs and whether or not they should redact any information in those logs. The organization, that decision was made by Julian alone. Secondly, when the charges were raised about his personal life in Sweden, all of these associates were saying, you really ought to step aside and let other people run WikiLeaks while you take care of the problems in your personal life. It's going to hurt the larger cause of the organization. And he told people to piss off. And I could read you the full quote, if you like. It's in my book. It was in Wired published, the transcript of the chat log between him and Daniel Domscheit-Berg. I think it hurts the larger cause that WikiLeaks represents for it to be so autocratically controlled. And I think that's why I say a year from now, we probably won't be talking so much about WikiLeaks as the larger movement for citizen-driven transparency. I think OpenLeaks, which is still in gestation, but which will be launching with a few initial partners, hopefully by this summer, may give us another model that is not so centralized. I mean, the reason why we're not getting more leaks out of WikiLeaks now, where's the Bank of America stuff? Where's the stuff that guy in Switzerland, who has now been arrested, handed him with all these people who are using Switzerland as a tax haven? Why hasn't that been released? And the answer is Julian won't answer. to me, it's true what my colleague to the left said about, journalists don't have to have likable personalities to do important work. I agree with that. But still, it's important to hold him accountable too, and he's refused. So I think we have to question that authority as well. And in the long run, it will be better if we have a more distributed network for whistleblowers getting their information out and not all being stopped up on Julian's laptop.
Glenn Greenwald.
Take the mic.
So I agree absolutely with the principle that that all organizations, including WikiLeaks, ought to be subjected to accountability. But I think one of the principal ways that people who stand up to political power are discredited and undermined is by having a tax raised on their personality. You can ask Daniel Ellsberg about that. And you know, if you listen to many of the media attacks on WikiLeaks, they focus on these tabloidy, personality-driven attributes of Julian Assange. You know, Bill Keller courageously reported that he actually wears dirty socks. And you know, a lot of a lot of the focus that has been directed at Julian
that
Assange.
That Bill Keller wears dirty socks?
What's that?
Bill Keller wears dirty socks?
No, that Julian Assange wears dirty socks.
I'm glad you clarified.
Bill Keller socks are pristine. And, you know, one of the things that I think is, you know, so important is that the scrutiny that Julian Assange has received is scrutiny that virtually nobody in power ever gets. Do you think the New York Times would ever write about the personality quirks of you leading U.S. senators or members of the House or the cabinet or anything else? So I do think that there are issues internally, like there are with most organizations. Mika earlier called Julian a flawed individual. I'm not aware of any individuals who are unflawed. But I think that in the context of what has happened overall, Julian Assange has fearlessly stood up to the world's most powerful factions in ways that most individuals can only dream about achieving. And whatever criticisms there are of his personality or management style pale completely in comparison to the good that he's done. And while I agree that accountability is needed for everyone, including him, I think we have to be careful not to focus on those kind of personality issues as a means of undermining and diluting the true good that WikiLeaks has done.
As an attorney for 20 years and a journalist and artist, how can we lawyers support you in the press best? Blogs, websites, what?
Loan your fees.
Very good answer.
Sorry.
Sorry,
that was a very flippant answer, but it's actually true. One of the things that the legal profession could do is lower its fees. We had a very interesting experience at The Guardian at the beginning of last year with a company called Trafigura, which had been illegally dumping toxic waste off the African coast. And it was our reporting of it was subjected to a super injunction, which meant that we couldn't even report the fact that a question had been asked about it in Parliament, which is one of those legal strictures that is threatening free speech. We actually kind of ended it somehow. The parliamentary question, ended up on a website, not ours, and it was pointed to by social media, including Twitter, and the hashtag Trafigura spread, started to trend. More people started to look at it because nobody knew what it was. And the entire case collapsed. But we did a kind of quick mental calculation on what that would have cost us to defend legally. And the answer was hundreds of thousands of dollars. The more serious answer to that is, in terms of how can the legal profession support, is I just think that it's enormously valuable for individual and collectives or corporations who are interested in doing good work to have the best legal advice on a number of fronts. And this is something which the professional journalism and amateur journalists need to be constantly informed. So publish clear, good information, guidelines on these things that would otherwise be very, very expensive to understand, where you're actually fighting quite often very well-resourced corporations as well as governments in terms of legality, because it's very important that people understand it. And it's actually something where the cost of it is prohibitive now for most non-mainstream news organizations.
Next question. Clearly, the discourse over the next 2 years will be dominated by corporate-sponsored voices who are running for president of the United States. What can we do to establish a widely heard counter-narrative?
I mean, I'll address that. Yeah, it's interesting. I think every single event that I ever do that talks about any sort of deficiencies in political or media institutions ultimately entails that question. And I'm glad it does, and it should. At the same time, I sometimes feel like the premise of the question is that things like what we're doing here today don't actually qualify as, quote, doing something. And I think, you know, if you look at even the events in the Middle East and the extraordinary way in which the most entrenched dictators have been overthrown pretty rapidly by some pretty disempowered citizenry that have been kept poor and uneducated, you see the power of citizens talking to one another about their discontent and persuading one another that the level of corruption is so great and the need for action is so great that massive collective action becomes possible. And there's all kinds of technologies now that allow people to build large audiences and to reach large numbers of their fellow citizens without having to rely upon corporate media entities. And I think that has succeeded greatly. I mean, just even the Bradley Manning situation exemplifies how that works. That's a controversy that took down the spokesman of the State Department who courageously spoke out against it, something quite out of character for him, but still commendable, that the president had to address and ultimately defend and created a serious controversy that all began on internet venues that are completely independent of and even hostile to corporate media outlets. Every single day, people who work in independent media, like Amy Goodman, like a lot of us, have the ability heightened to be able to influence public discourse, to have ideas that used to be excluded injected into the public dialogue. And I think I'm at least pretty optimistic about that trend continuing.
Okay, if, just very quickly, Ed, I don't know if this, if we can break the dominant narrative, but just adding to what Glenn said, if you live in Iowa or New Hampshire, or you know people who do, or you want to spend some time up there, that is the only moment where we actually can access these candidates when they're most vulnerable. So show up at these meetings with your camera, video, put it up on the web, ask them hard questions. We've got a window there. Before they get completely, put behind the velvet rope. So let's take advantage of it.
Today is Dan Ellsberg's 80th birthday, as I think you noted, Greg. He is devoting everything now to helping Bradley Manning. And I don't know if we've gotten a clear description of what is happening with Bradley Manning right now. If you could just tell us, what is the situation, Greg, Glenn?
Well, it's in a way gone into a bit of a blackout the last couple of weeks after all the protests. And it was very revealing that it took P.J. Crowley, the State Department flack, to protest that finally after, 9 months, the editorial pages of the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times and some other papers for the first time raised a protest against his conditions. You know, Glenn was so influential in helping to expose this last December, and even after the blackout before December ended, we had 3 or 4 months where not a peep was said by any of these media outlets about it. So, but it took the State Department flack losing his job for that to happen. Since then, and the controversy, there really hasn't been much known. I suspect perhaps maybe his conditions have been eased. We heard from his attorney for the first time just yesterday, after he was quiet for some time, and he revealed, I guess rather shockingly, or not so, that Denis Kucinich, the UN person who is, thank you. Kucinich, the UN representative who is investigating Manning's, the conditions, and an Amnesty International official have all been denied the chance to visit Manning. So that was the latest update, that we've had as of yesterday. So obviously things are not all well there in any case.
Glenn, anything else you want to add? Okay. Where does the underground organization Anonymous fit into the movement to push back? Should this type of citizen hacktivism be supported and emulated? Isn't the only power we have, isn't this the only power we have against corporations?
I cover Anonymous a little bit in my book, and it's fascinating. First of all, for people who don't know, it's hard to describe, because, and that's part of the idea, I think, is because it's amorphous, it's distributed, it, again, like WikiLeaks, is stateless, and sometimes it's incredibly immature and misogynist and racist. Not everything that has been claimed by Anonymous as its activities is progressive. In the case of the WikiLeaks pushback, they did a number of things that were really quite good, like rallying people to dig into the cables to try and highlight, the news that was not being exposed. The more controversial tactic is this distributed denial of service attacks, where they've made it possible for people, it's risky, by the way, if you do this, to, download a bit of software, put it on your computer, and then when Anonymous somehow decides to go after a target, your computer will help try and take down a website. And they did this to PayPal, and they did this to MasterCard, Visa, a bank in Switzerland. They did it to the lawyer who was handling the case in Sweden of the two women who were making charges against Assange. And you know, there's a debate in my community over whether or not this is legitimate civil disobedience or not. I mean, in civil disobedience, I think you risk going to jail. You are not anonymous. You are making an act of moral, you know, you're taking a stand and you're willing to also, you know, admit that you're crossing the line. Here it is anonymous. That's one issue that we have to wrestle with. The other one, and this is just my personal view, is that embracing this specific tactic of the distributed denial of service is very dangerous. It's like saying we should legalize poison gas. It's gonna blow back mostly onto the weaker websites. Human rights organizations, dissident groups, who cannot afford to defend themselves from these kinds of attacks. Big corporations, you know, it's a little bit like a lot of mosquitoes biting them for a day. It may feel good, it may be good for visibility, but it hardly seems like the smartest thing to promote.
I just have a little bit of a different view. I mean, it's true, Anonymous is a very amorphous collective, so it's extremely difficult to talk about them monolithically, and there's lots of stuff they've done that's worthy of criticism. So I'm going to ignore those parts and address only the issue about what they've done in the WikiLeaks situation. If we had a perfect world, I would say that we ought to discourage the kinds of illegal denial of service attacks that they were launching, because it can lead to all sorts of anarchy, and Mika's right that then weaker sites are more vulnerable. But that's not the world we have. The world in which we live is one in which the world's most powerful factions are using cyber attacks very aggressively. And in my view, what has been so revealing about the Anonymous case is that shortly before Anonymous launched these attacks, WikiLeaks was targeted by a vastly more powerful and sophisticated cyber attack that actually knocked them offline in the United States and prevented any US hosting companies from continuing to keep them online. And for some very strange reason, the Justice Department has been very interested in finding who's responsible for the Anonymous attacks, but hasn't evinced any interest at all in finding out who is responsible for those attacks on WikiLeaks. And that shows you, even though those attacks are every bit as illegal and were far more threatening and sophisticated, and that shows you that there's already this war that's being waged over internet freedom, and the only question is whether the war will be fought in a one-sided way or a two-sided way. And although I wish that denial of service attacks and cyber attacks weren't part of the internet and weren't threatening internet freedom, the reality is that they are, and I think engaging that fight and preventing it from being a one-sided attack on balance is probably preferable than simply ceding the field to government and corporate authorities.
As we wrap up, if each of you can talk about how they can access your information, each of you just explain the website or where you're tweeting, everything.
Sorry, how they can act like that?
Yeah, find out.
I'm Emily, at Emily Belt on Twitter, which is where I post also my profile links to the my personal website, the Columbia website, and I put my phone number on there as well, because, you know, hey, it's information.
Right. Our website is alliance.org.au. Or a lot of this information, and a lot of the articles that have been written about this issue by Australian journalists from an Australian perspective are on our professional website, which is walkleys.com. W-A-L, that's the Australian A, as in A for America. W-A-L-K-E-Y-S.
So personaldemocracy.com is where you can find all the information about the conference, as well as our blogs. The conference is coming up June 6th and 7th in New York. And if you're interested, the early bird rate is expiring at the end of next week. The way to find me on Twitter is MLSIF. And I will just make a very self-promoting plea, which is if you are reading my book right now, or thinking about reading, whatever, tweet at me that you're reading the book. I want to create a list of people who are reading it, and then I want to try and use the internet to figure out some way to gather people in a conversation and see if we can't channel some of that interest into supporting the movement for transparency. So MLSIF on Twitter.
Well, I'm still doing the live blog at The Nation every single day, so it should be pretty easy to find that also.
It's day 132.
Yes, I've lost track, but and I do other stories at The Nation as well, so pretty easy. Twitter is at Greg Mitch, and I'm having a book signing for my two WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning books this afternoon at 3:45, so I invite you to stop by and chat, even if you don't buy the book. So thank you.
I write pretty much on a daily basis at salon.com, where you can find my column, my blog. And I also have come to terms recently with the fact that I seem to have developed a Twitter addiction, which manifests at Twitter at G Greenwald. I'm trying to curb that a little bit, but so far have been unsuccessful, so you can find me there as well. G Greenwald, Twitter, G Greenwald. Salon.com.
Know that it's Odyssey Books that's here. Independent bookstores are endangered, and they're very important. They're from Western Mass, and everyone will be signing books there. I'll also be signing books. And my Democracy Now! Colleagues, Juan Gonzalez, who just won the Polk Award again yesterday, is going to be speaking, as well as Sharif. Sharif Abdelkaddous, he's speaking out in Seattle now. He did an incredible job covering the uprising in Egypt, and he's going back to continue to do that, to tune into his reports at Democracy Now!, but he'll be here tomorrow, so come out for his speech as well. A few years ago, Glenn Greenwald won the first Izzy Award, and in Micha Sifri's introduction to his book, excuse me?
It was my co-award.
I can't remember. he once again quotes the great I.F. Stone, and we should remember this quote as we go out today. All governments lie, but disaster lies in wait for countries whose officials smoke the same hashish they give out. Thank you very much for joining us.